are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
Support for today's show comes from No Ordinary Lawsuit, a podcast that takes listeners behind the scenes of Giuliani versus United States, a constitutional climate lawsuit brought by 21 young Americans against the federal government. The most recent episode examines what the U.S. government knew about the dangers of climate change and when. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It's Thursday, February 28th, 2019. My name is Michael Brooks on a Michael Thursday. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We're broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, journalist, political analyst Milton Alamadi joins us. We're talking about the anti-austerity democratic movement still rolling through Sudan, the violent suppression and state of emergency declared by Sudanese leader Omar al-Bashir. Why did all the same people who several years ago were so worried about Darfur not worried about a new crisis in Sudan that implicates the global economic order? Also, we'll touch on South Africa gearing up for elections in May. Who are the players? Is the new Cyril Ramaphosa ANC reclaiming the heroism and heritage of the liberation movement, or is it continuing to fail to deliver for the poor? But are there any alternatives? If that is the case, Milton and I will tackle it. Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un have abruptly ended their summit in Hanoi with no deal, but apparently they're still friends as we continue to live in the fallout of the destruction of the enormously successful Iran deal. Iran's foreign minister, Javad Zarif, the architect of so much progress in things like the Iran deal, said a couple of days ago he wanted to resign. President Rouhani refused to allow him to do so, so he's still there. Michael Cohen, in addition to confirming all of the obvious grotesqueness of Donald Trump, did he reveal a fascistic threat in the form of saying Donald Trump won't necessarily leave power if he loses power in 2020. Betsy DeVos is pitching a new tax credit to support school choice programs as she continues her low-key rampage through public education. The Republican North Carolina political operative who was indicted on election fraud might be facing new charges. In that case, Pakistan has released an Indian pilot, slightly cooling down the crisis on the subcontinent. Venezuelans might be profoundly dissatisfied with their government, but they overwhelmingly oppose U.S. interference and coups. Cubans registered dissent, but in an apparently clean poll, affirm their support for socialism with reform, as the U.S. administration also suggests that this broader far-right push in Latin America might also take aim at Cuba. Beto O'Rourke, why can't he just take out a fascist in the Senate? Apparently, he wants to join the 2020 field.
Boo. More like Budo O'Rourke.
Yeah, Budo O'Rourke. Transgender service members testify before Congress about Trump's possible ban. Medicare for All push exposes corporate lame Democrats as that bill moves forward. India's forest dwellers are protesting a new government move against deforestation, belying the government's self-proclaimed commitment to Indian traditions. And the United Nations suggests that Israel committed war crimes in Gaza, even as prosecutors have unveiled charges just a couple of minutes ago of bribery, fraud, and breach of the public trust against Benjamin Netanyahu, who will be out campaigning with some of the biggest overt racists in Israeli society. All that and more on today's Majority Report. Let's get started. The three of us are here. Let's get started with people miss when we talk about Sebastian Gorka. And look, you know, the guy is really unimportant. He's kind of back to the like the terrify senior citizens at a buffet in Palm Beach about Hezbollah circuit. And he's got some dumb radio show, which, you know, I mean, hey, I welcome anybody who wants to call and share your thoughts about him with him. Tell him about himself on his radio show if you're so inclined. Gorka's back. He's back in the game. He was at the CPAC conference. And I mean, he really is the most David Brent thing in the world. This is Sebastian Gorka talking about what's really going on with the Green New Deal.
The biggest threat to America is not socialism in Moscow, socialism here in America.
Polite applause.
According to the amazing Victims of Communism Memorial Foundation, they did a poll last year in which they found that 52% of American millennials would like to live in a socialist or communist America.
Hell yeah, Pete.
That, yes indeed, boo, yes indeed, hiss. That is why 40 Democrat candidates in the last midterm election called themselves socialists. That is why Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez...
Oh my God, he's begging for a boo here.
...has introduced the Green New Deal, which is, remember this one, use it, it's a watermelon. Green on the outside, deep, deep red communist on the inside. They want to take your pickup truck. They want to rebuild your home. They want to take away your hamburgers. This is what Stalin dreamt about but never achieved.
Right.
You are on the front lines of the war against communism coming back to America under the guise of democratic socialism, which is just a PC term for communism. I want everyone to take to heart Donald J. Trump is never going to let it happen. And as he said to Congress, America will never be a socialist country.
Just soak it in.
Soaking it in.
This is my public.
This is my heroic journey. Pause, looking down with other members of the
America
BTN.
First. America First, that's a great name for a radio show. Have you heard of it?
Plug.
Check it out.
Time.
America First, America Always. God bless all of you. Can I ask you a favor before I go? The boss always likes this. Can you stand up and we'll give you a thumbs up? Come on, everybody. God bless.
God bless. America First Radio, sponsored by Webistics, which you might remember from season 2 of The Sopranos.
It's not a very alpha way to end a speech, to take a picture for your boss. The boss loves when I do this.
Everybody, we're going to crush communists, crush socialists. Now, if you wouldn't mind, can we take a selfie for the boss? When I say Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, that's your signal to start booing. There's a new Amazonian root that cures diabetes. They've bought block advertising. Look out, Glenn Beck, you're days are numbered.
Now, if you'll excuse me, I rented a Lexus today.
I mean, this guy's whole career, it's amazing. It's like you get some like joke degree and then you just, you go on the circuit and it's somewhere, it's a cross of hilarious and terrifying because on one hand, that's not totally a joke. I'm sure there are a lot of like, you know, concerned seniors at the Palm Springs luncheon for saving democracy from Islamo-terrorism. And this buffoon goes up there and basically, you know, terrifies a bunch of 80-year-olds that should be sitting on the beach and enjoying their golden years. But instead, he's there going like, what you don't realize is that when you're on your way to get your macchiato, Hamas is watching, like shooting cortisol off in their bodies. And then in a non-tragic comic way, this is also the type, these like, you know, pseudo-terrorism experts were hired by local police departments and other law enforcement agencies where they actually are basically just fueling, you know, conspiracies, bigotry, and propaganda to loop into actual initiatives against like the Muslim community. And so this is a roundabout way of saying, you know, look, Sebastian, if everybody could get a rich wife, a bullshit degree, and become some type of weird, like, David Brent of fake terrorism studies, maybe we wouldn't all be democratic socialists.
Yes, indeed. Boo. Yes, indeed. Hiss.
Before we abolish ICE, it's got one last operation. I can't wait till this guy, that should be a new demand for 2020 Democrats, is deport Sebastian Gorka. Did he acknowledge his association with various undesirables on his immigration application? Did he?
I don't know. I think I saw something in the tablet that said that was all fine.
Oh, it was all, oh, yeah. I think you'll find that connections to fascist movements in Europe are totally fine if you're willing to say that Palestinians aren't human beings. You must be wearing orthotics because you stand corrected. All right, guys, we're going to take a brief break and we'll be right back with the great political analyst Milton Alamadi. We're talking about the movements in Sudan and upcoming elections in South Africa. Welcome back to the Majority Report. Michael Brooks here. Joining us now is Milton Alamadi. He's the publisher of Black Star News and a adjunct professor of African history at John Jay College. Milton, thank you so much. Also, I should say you can regularly hear him on the Michael Brooks Show.
Hey, it's my pleasure, man. Thank you for having me on your show again.
Oh, thank you so much for being here, man. I just always learn so much and appreciate talking with you.
Likewise, you ask good questions too, and I end up learning something.
Wow. All right. That is honestly a very big honor to hear from you. So before I get too embarrassed by that, let me try to continue that tradition of asking good questions. In the Sudan right now, there has been an ongoing movement for a couple of months now, and the leader, Omar al-Bashir, has just announced a form of kind of martial law for a year and also reshuffled his cabinet. Can you explain, I guess, what's happening? What is the movement? Who is the government in power? People know Omar al-Bashir as certainly a very brutal leader responsible for a lot of crimes. But these protests, although the response to them has been violent, might fit into more of a story that might in some ways have more to do with, as an example, something like the Yellow Vest movement and also the policies that Omar al-Bashir has actually followed that are very in line with the demands of global capital.
Absolutely. Omar al-Bashir has been in power for like 30 years now. You know, he took power in a military coup. And at the time when he took power, he was supported by Hassan al-Turabi, the late Hassan Turabi, who was like a scholar and one of the leading Islamists in Sudan. A big advocate of strict Sharia law. And after he helped Bashir seize power, they pushed with a strict interpretation of Sharia, pushing it in the southern part of the country as well. And in fact, it ended the peace agreement that had existed and escalated the civil war in the Sudan. As a result, South Sudan is today an independent country. It won its independence after it had a referendum. It had a lot of support from the U.S., been independent since 2011. And why do I bring that up? That's a critical issue because when South Sudan became an independent state, along with it went all the major oil fields. And Sudan relied on oil for 80% of its income. So when all the oil disappeared, Sudan now had no major revenue source. It became increasingly dependent on the Gulf states for assistance, and it became really dependent on loans to survive. The economy is now indebted to the tune of $50 billion. That's the debt burden. By December of last year, the people could not take that pressure anymore. Inflation was, I think, running at around 80%. The price of bread, which is a major staple, went up like by 300%, while the size itself, the size of the loaves of bread shrunk by 50%. Mm. You needed a special permit to buy several loaves of bread, and you're only allowed to buy it if you need it for like a funeral or for weddings. So that was the extent of the pressure by December. So what started out as, they call it the bread protest, then of course escalated very quickly because they realized this is all ongoing under the same leadership of the last 30 years. So at that point, the professional, the unions of professionals in Sudan, and they've always had very well-organized unions and professional class, particularly the students and the teachers, engineers, and other professionals. They started taking the lead. And December 25th, they held one of the largest public protests in Sudan's history. So we had transitioned very quickly from a bread protest to a a sure must-go protest. And there's so much pressure now that journalists that I speak with in Sudan tell me that they believe that his time is up. It will not be quickly, but eventually they see him perhaps being overthrown in a military coup d'etat. Well, because obviously the army would like to maintain its role in Sudanese politics. And yeah. Obviously the people that are out in the streets now don't want that. So even if the army get rid of him, that will not resolve the crisis. I think the pressure will continue. The professional class, the students, they want to transition away from military rule in the Sudan. That's what's happening. And in terms of the outside bearing on neoliberal economics, World Bank, IMF, that of course applies not only to the Sudan, but pretty much every African country.
Right.
And I'm glad you raised that, because at the end of the day, the countries are different, but the stories are pretty much the same. Mm. Countries that cannot really exercise economic control, the decisions made outside by institutions like the World Bank and IMF determine the fate of almost every African country.
So, and that was actually going to be my follow-up question, which you already covered, which is the distinction between a change at the top, which gets rid of a personality, versus a structural revolution. I mean, this is a conversation we're seeing with regard to Haiti right now. You know, people demonstrating wanting a wholesale rejection of a system in place that is backed and fortified by the United States and other colonial interests, and also broad-based discredited political parties across the spectrum in Haiti. So that's what the protests are about. So when we talk about that with regards to Sudan, what does power look like in Sudan today? I think you gave us a good understanding of the unions, the mobilization, the students, the demand to end the military role in Sudanese politics. But if the Sudan has lost oil, which was my understanding of what made Sudan a prominent and important player in fortified relations with places like China, what is the significance of Sudan to the Gulf countries as an example? And what role beyond Bashir does this military, does this government play as something of a power broker in its part of the world? Like, what are the networks that keep that militarized system in place, and how can they be undermined by the movement?
I think the military will find it very difficult to sustain itself, because who and how will it be able to address the $50 billion debt burden? They can't do that. The professional class have to really step in. They have to have a government of civilians, people that are trained in economics, people that have been in the forefront of leading the social movement in the Sudan, the activists. And these are professional people who don't want the continuation of a military regime. So I think the tide is actually in their favor. At some point, even after they get rid of Bashir, they will have to contend with the fact that they won't be able to sustain government by themselves. In terms of why is Sudan still significant? Sudan is significant because it's able now to say that it's playing a role in suppressing the migration of people across to North Africa, then into Europe. Mm-hmm. So it's playing that card now, which a couple of African countries are actually playing today, that, hey, EU, I can play a role in making sure that Africans aren't coming en masse into Europe. And for that reason alone, there's value in, at least to the West, in sustaining Bashir in power. Mm-hmm. As you notice, it's not by coincidence that a few months ago, sanctions were actually lifted, meaning Sudan was being brought back into the neoliberal establishment, reintegrated, when in fact nothing has changed since Bashir was the pariah, since he was indicted by the ICC. Is this still the same Bashir, right? So nothing has changed structurally. But this would have continued as the narrative had the economy not just blown up in December. So that's why he's now becoming increasingly expendable. And I think the stopgap measure is going to be perhaps a transitional military government. And I think there'll be so much pressure on that government that at some point they might actually allow open elections in the Sudan. And this is actually a good opportunity for a new class of politicians to emerge in the Sudan. Because as you notice, the pressure is not coming so much from established political parties. Mm-hmm. The pressure is actually coming from the professional unions and the students, who now have much more credibility than the official opposition parties. So just because Bashir is out, it does not mean that the traditional opposition parties are going to inherit the state. I think the unions and the students are going to play a significant role into whatever type of government is established in Sudan.
Forgive me for this like glib analogy, but it's like if you're the union student movement, you have to get through Bashir, then you have to get through the military and traditional patronage networks and oligarchies in the Sudan, and then you need to get through the Gulf states, the West, the World Bank, and IMF. It's these various levels of coercion and control
it's part of the challenge that actually is faced by many, many African countries.
Right.
Because barring that, if things don't evolve into that direction, unfortunately, things are going to get a lot much worse than they are today. People are now surviving by what they've called now, like it's more like a Twitter economy, because there's such a shortage of essential products, including medicines, that people actually tweet and say, I need this critical type of medicine. When are you coming to the Sudan? And then somebody could make that connection and say, I'll be there in about a month or so. Right. And I can bring you X quantities of supply. You bring it, and then you make the transaction once you get into that country. That's how bad things are today, economically, in Sudan.
And also that the xenophobia and the resurgence of far-right fortification and wall politics in Europe and the United States. But we should be clear, this goes back at least certainly to the 90s. All of the Eurozone and the United States were in violation of their own obligations under international refugee treaties going back a couple of decades. But
absolutely,
the way,
I'm glad you brought that up.
Yeah, and you can elaborate it, please. But I just want to just really underline that they are able to the synergy in repression internally with the kind of broad-based repression of the Europe in the United States in terms of wanting to keep people out, that's where there's a lot of these strategic alliances that are forged between a place like Bashir's Sudan and the European Union, as an example. Respond to that, and maybe if we could also connect it to the contrast in coverage. You know, I remember back in like 2007 or so, Darfur and other areas where Omar al-Bashir, and of course, I'm sure it was more complicated than it was presented, but we could certainly say, of course, Omar al-Bashir was involved in crimes against humanity and various atrocities, mm-hmm. no question. And Sudan was an area where George Clooney was on TV, where there was you were supposed to wear a green pin, I think it was. There was a lot of energy. Now, in a moment where, and including some of the other things that have been astonishing and amazing about these protests, which everybody can learn from globally, everywhere, you know, east, west, north, south, has been actually people saying on the streets in Khartoum, like, we are Darfuri. We don't want to be divided by the various, divisions that the Bashir regime has exploited, just the way all right-wing governments do to divide people from uniting around common interests. It's a, it's an old story. We see it everywhere. It's not a factor here. It barely registers in news in the United States that this guy that so much energy was put into in civil society and in kind of pop humanitarian concern. Well, there might actually be an opportunity to actually depose this guy who's committed so many crimes from power, and it's not even a blip.
There are multiple factors. You and I know because if we go with the most basic one, it's people really don't care that much things that happen in Africa, in this country. And that's the honest and tragic truth. So when it comes to, like, issues of governance and democracy, even people that are really sympathetic toward Africa, you really wonder how much they believe that Africans are able to operate a functional, democratic, accountable system. So, yes, Bashir was really bad at that time because he was actively engaged in a lot of that killing. But since at least we're not hearing that he's that much involved in those types of killings anymore, then why should we really care who gets to run this event? And I think that kind of attitude, unfortunately, applies to many African countries as well. I think there's a certain representation that's lasted for such a long time that's developed that deep-seated perception toward Africa in general, that they pretty much have what they deserve anyway, you see? Because people have not been able to see a different alternative existing in Africa generally for a long time. So that is also one of the underlying things behind it, you know, in terms of my own perspective. If you look at functioning democratic accountable countries in Africa, how many are there really? You can point to South Africa, of course, Namibia, Botswana, Ghana, Senegal, Sierra Leone, Liberia coming back. But people have the perception that those are exceptional. But the general norm is for Africa to be like what we see in the Sudan today. So unless things are really, really bad, when we hear daily reporting, ongoing genocide, then it's time for us to get outraged. When we hear mass starvation, with all those images of starving Africa, then perhaps it's time for us to get outraged. So unfortunately, that plays into it as well. But you brought up a very good point in terms of the outside role in creating the conditions that caused these mass migrations in the first place. And we can assume that things are much worse today than they were in the 60s and 70s, 80s. Because at that time, we never saw scenes of thousands of Africans drowning, trying to cross the Mediterranean or to even get through the desert. We don't even know how many are dying in the deserts to get to the shores before they can try to cross the Mediterranean. We never had these kind of scenes in the 60s, 70s, 80s. But progressively, the relationship in terms of Africa's economy and its relation to the industrial world has deteriorated significantly in these decades. And then you combine with that people being displaced from the land, because in many cases, the elite or the regimes are displacing their own people and reaching deals with foreign investors for commercial farming. And so you find unemployment going up. You find no source of income. That's why these young people are so desperate. I mean, think about it. You know that others that are going ahead of you are drowning and dying, and yet you still engage in that activity. Right. And when they go to Europe, it's not like they go to hang out in the streets. They go wherever they get there, they find work, and they start sending money back to their family. Europe. That's how desperate things are. So I'm glad you brought the connection, because all we see is when read this say no, or you watch typical corporate media, they only present the images of the drowning young people. You never get to figure out why is it that they're making those desperate journeys in the first place.
Yeah. Let's go to South Africa, where there are elections actually that are going to be taking place in a couple of months,
yes, in May. Right.
Let's, for before we, you know, we'll get to that in a second, but I think the setup, and maybe it will be useful just to go, I guess we'll just go through a personality to get to the bigger issues. President
yes.
Cyril Ramaphosa, he's been in power for about a year. Do you want to maybe, if you could give a brief introduction to who he is and how his first year has been. This is somebody with an extremely complicated legacy. Who is he and how has it been going?
Cyril Ramaphosa is an agent of the mining monopoly capital industry in France. Cyril Ramaphosa, as you recall, was involved in the massacre of the miners at the Maracana mine. And he sat on the board of that company.
Milton, sorry, you're cutting out a little bit, so I don't know what happened.
Sorry.
But just yes, that's perfect. Whatever it is you just did is perfect. So please, stay where you are and reset it,
okay.
Please. Thank you.
Okay, I'm sorry about that.
No.
But please. You heard the part about him being an agent of monopoly capital in the mining industry, correct?
Yes, we heard that. Yes. So take it from there. Yeah.
Right. So Cyril Ramaphosa is basically going to continue to be an enforcer. Cyril Ramaphosa, the only thing he can sell is that he's not as corrupt as Jacob Zuma.
Right.
But obviously, corruption also depends on how you define it, right? Mm-hmm. If you sign these immoral deals with multinational companies and the deals result in displacement of your citizens, or in the case of the Maracana miners, even in the massacres, that typically we don't see it as corruption. But that to me is an ultimate form of corruption. So while Zuma's was like, I wouldn't say petty corruption because it's still egregious, it's a different type of corruption. He was blatantly giving these contracts to supporters and acolytes and the Gupta family, which obviously were also helping to finance his own deals in South Africa. So that is to the extent that I would introduce Cyril Ramaphosa. I don't see him as an agent of change. Absolutely not. He can just say, I'm much, much better than Jacob Zuma, the previous corrupt president of South Africa. And he is the flag bearer of the ANC, and the ANC is projected to win, but probably with a smaller margin. I think they now have 240 seats in the 400-seat parliament. But the pressure is coming from not so much from the Democratic Alliance, which is now the other major opposition party. I think they have about 90 seats in parliament.
Mm-hmm.
I think more pressure is probably coming from the Economic Freedom Party of Malema,
mm-hmm.
which only has about 25 seats. But what they've done is they've focused on an issue which is a burning issue in South Africa, and that is land reform. So by being way ahead of all the other parties, the ANC actually, I mean the EFF of Malema, being way ahead in terms of agitating for land reform, the ANC had to catch up and start changing a lot of its own policies and becoming much more militant. Started talking about land reform for the first time last year. And in fact, they passed the legislation, and it was supported by the ANC and the EFF, and the DA opposed it. So the DA finds itself now, the Democratic Alliance, at a very odd point in its history, in its evolution. Obviously, it came up at a time when ANC was seen as being, monopolizing too much power in South Africa. And as a result of that, their corruption increased. It was no longer the party of Nelson Mandela. And that's why there was an opening for the Democratic Alliance. But now when it finds itself having to oppose the just demands for land reform, I think that's going to have a negative impact
into its election prospects. South Africa today has a burning issue. I think it's not possible to embrace economic, political democracy while you have economic tyranny, really.
Right.
It's not possible. How can you have a situation where 25 years after Mandela was first elected and apartheid officially ended, where you have the white population, which makes up about 8.9% now, I think it's gone down, it was about 11 to 12, owning 74% of the farms, of the land, and 80% of the population, the black population, owning 4% of the farmland. That's just not sustainable. And then you have it in the economic sphere as well, where white households' income is about six times more than black households. I think if South Africa does not really redress this situation sooner rather than later, even the economic, the political democracy that it enjoys today will be under tremendous pressure. I don't see how it would be able to be sustained.
So that makes total sense. And I just want to be really clear, when we talk about land reform and land expropriation, I want, the reason people need to think about this really carefully and really clinically is that there's going to be, there already is an unbelievable amount of fear-mongering and lying and propaganda about it that takes place in the United States and in Australia. And it's actually a new trope of the global alt-right and neo-Nazis, right, and so on. And I think it's very important. I mean, I just want to put two things. We'll get to the next question in a second. But, one, as an example, the landless workers movement in Brazil, David Harvey, the economist, he said it was the most perfect social movement he'd ever seen in the world. And in a lot of these cases, at least in Brazil, but my understanding is also in South Africa, you're talking about, you're not talking about a mom and pop, Afrikaner farms with a couple of pigs and a couple of chickens and a pickup truck, right? You're talking about, it's like the same way the estate tax gets talked about in the United States. Conversation is not about taking that family that I just picked, painted that picture. They're staying in their little house. You're talking about huge, massive swaths of land that,
yes,
through
about miles of land,
miles,
right,
through racialized capital accumulation, have been, in a way that you can understand through the racial hierarchy and also through just raw, like Marxists would say, primitive accumulation, just stolen land that has been turned into property through the fictitious of contracts. And you're saying this is going to be handed back to worker cooperatives, to small farmers, and so on. And that is definitely going to mean that some oligarchs are going to lose assets. But this is, yes, totally not a question of again, taking that small Afrikaner farmer off of their land. In fact, if it's done properly, it will help the small Afrikaner farmer as well.
Of course.
Right.
Of course. There's so much. There's enough for everybody.
Right.
But it goes back to greed.
Right.
It's a way of wanting to continue apartheid without officially calling it apartheid anymore. That's what it is.
Right.
So it's going to maybe not this generation of white South Africans that are still the beneficiaries, but if the next generation are also still being, their mentality is conditioned by the current beneficiaries, and of course they benefit as well.
Yep.
I don't see how it's going to happen. I think perhaps we could go back and say the critical moment really was 25 years ago. 25 years ago, that was really when a lot of these issues should have been brought out. And the longer that time passes, I don't see the beneficiaries being in a position to now, as Amilcar Cabral once famously said,
how do you get the bourgeoisie to commit suicide, really? Hmm. Because that's what it is. You have to make a conscious choice that it's now time for me to sacrifice, to be willing to let go of all this wealth that I have in order to increase the number of beneficiaries. Yes, I will let go of a lot of wealth, but I'll still be wealthy. Because I'm saying if they don't do that, at the end of the day, they might end up with nothing. You can't stop it. I mean, it's a momentum that nothing else would be able to sustain. You can't go back to old school apartheid,
right?
So what are you going to do?
What happens to a dream deferred?
In a way, mm-hmm. I'm sorry?
I said, what happens to a dream deferred, they would say, right?
No, really, think about it.
Yeah.
So South Africa, I think to me, that is the critical thing right now. That is the real story that, you know, obviously, as you say, in the Western capitals, is not seen as the major issue. The major issue is Jacob Zuma's corruption. Yes, that is an issue, but that is not the big explosive time bomb that is really affecting South Africa. Similarly, in Namibia has exact same type of situation, where in fact it's written in the constitution as it exists today that there would be no land reform, mm-hmm. that the beneficiaries of the land at the time Namibia had its independence would continue to own the land. So Namibia, they would have to change the constitution as well. The majority of the land are owned by the previous white elite that are no longer even in Namibia today.
Right.
So absentee landlords. And so obviously that to me is one of the burning issues in South Africa. The land and the wealth and income distribution and the unemployment. Unemployment is increasing. I think it's up to like 28% or 29% now. And that's really hard in a situation where you have an increasingly modernized economy. You know, you can imagine an industrial economy with an employment rate of almost 30%. What do people do? And that's why when you say South Africa has one of the highest crime rates in the world, which is absolutely true. But then, of course, if you look at the factors, the economic factors, it should not be surprising to anybody.
Right. And the last thing in the last couple of minutes, and it's big, but just to add to how disturbing it is, it seems like my read of it is that there has been obviously a very powerful tradition in the liberation movement in the ANC, Chris Hani, Ronnie Kasrils of basically right. the socialist Marxist wing. And yeah. Ronnie Kasrils has been, I've interviewed him. I mean, he was the former intelligence chief. He said, look,
I remember he wrote that book.
Like, yeah. And he said, look, we said basically we acquiesced to the Washington consensus economic policies to get political power. And what has happened, though, in this process that seems really disturbing is that, you know, Jacob Zuma did this kind of fusion of basically just fake populism and corruption. Now you have, you know, the ANC under Cyril Ramaphosa, who, as you say, I mean, and people should look into him, because the tragedy of Ramaphosa is not only is he cut his teeth as maybe the most successful, outstanding union leader in South Africa's history. I mean, this guy was an incredible.
The original Ramaphosa, right. Yeah, you're right. Just this, people bringing that up.
Yeah,
you should have. Right.
Yeah, I mean, just this incredible force in the 1980s internally fighting apartheid and capital monopoly capital in South Africa. So, but he's really trying to pull, he's almost like I would put him in the same kind of geospace as like Emmanuel Macron. He's kind of trying to do a third way neoliberal thing in a world where that's gone, you know, particularly in South Africa. That kind of consensus is not going to work. And then the Democratic Alliance is, they're even further, and they're also a neoliberal party, but without any of the ANC coalition partners and traditions that still have legitimacy. And the trouble with the EFF is that they raise the right issues and they are correct in some of their diagnosis, but they're really more of a, you know, essentialist, populist party than a kind of radical socialist one. And they have their own, you know, charges of corruption and immigrant scapegoating, in addition to at times thing, you know, making categorical statements about the Afrikaners, which obviously contradict the ANC tradition. So an actual left, you know, presence that could do the radical redistribution and restore democracy, it's not there. I guess
it's not there.
Yeah.
And I think the one, it really makes you now appreciate how tragic it was when Steve Biko was murdered in 1977. And people that, any listeners that are not familiar with Steve Biko, please go do the research, look him up. He has some very interesting speeches that you can listen to on YouTube. You can read his book, I Write What I Like. And I think it's only about 10-minute or 15-minute interview where he spoke about the South Africa that he had a vision of. And he said there would have to be a redistribution of wealth. He said it would be meaningless to just say we are going to replace the white political elite and political elite with black South Africans, and that would be it. So there would be no change, no difference. We'd be facing the same issues. And he was absolutely on point. You wonder if Steve Biko had not been murdered, perhaps the young class of young leaders that he would have been able to train and nurture to come after him. Because that is what South Africa lacks. The EFF don't have the intellectual grounding that Steve Biko had and the vision that he had for South Africa. Trained as a medical doctor, but a brilliant organizer, and a deep understanding of the economy, as people will be able to tell if they go to YouTube and they listen to what he's saying. You know, personally, I feel that South Africa, Ghana, Sudan, you name it, any African country, in order for them to change the equation domestically, they have to change their bargaining power with the industrial world. Mm-hmm. And another good teacher on that front was the late Samir Amin, who just died about a year ago. I also recommend people not familiar with him to look him up, also listen to some of his lectures on YouTube. Because he said, basically, what African countries need to do is to integrate their economies and not be dependent on just stationary factories in their countries, having industries without industrializing. In other words, they're just renting space for foreign multinationals who go there to set up the factories so they can benefit from cheap labor, cheap resources, and also markets for their products. And who sustained this regime? As we started out earlier in the show, the World Bank and the IMF, because they make access to capital conditional. If you want loans, if you want financing, hey, everybody needs a loan to start something, if you were financing, business, anything. If you want these loans, these are the conditions. The conditions, you allow multinationals to come to set up here, basically with no rules. You allow free imports of products, meaning you'll never be able to manufacture those products yourself. When, as you know, historically, every country that is industrialized today had to protect industry for a certain period of time. So Samir Amin is saying African countries cannot do that individually. They don't have the political will, power to sustain the pressure that would come from the outside world. So they need to start thinking regionally and collectively and be on the same page. Then they can start negotiating some advantages and start gaining from the tremendous resources they have. Look at a country like the Congo, for example, $27 trillion worth of resources. It has the product that goes into all these cell phones and electronic equipment, as you know, coltan. Right. And it has about 60% of the world's cobalt, which is going to be the biggest thing now as electric cars become increasingly much more important. And yet you find per capita income in Congo less than $3,000. And it will remain that way until Congo South Africa, Namibia, Ghana, Sudan, unless they can really change their bargaining power with the industrial world. I always like to say, I remind people, I tell my students, what people who saw the film Lumumba, Raoul Peck's film, remember that scene when the Belgian general, who's now being fired by Patrice Lumumba, he told his African soldiers, he said, as far as I'm concerned, after independence equals before independence. And tragically, if it comes to the structural structures of the African economies, that is absolutely the same. It's like Berlin Conference in 1884-85, when the continent was partitioned. And it was set up basically as a reservoir for cheap labor and raw materials. It's exactly the same today in the 21st century.
Milton Alamadi, we will try to play our parts and always just learn so much from you. Obviously, there'll be links to all the ways that you can follow Milton Alamadi's work, which you just simply not only need to be doing, but you'll actually have a tremendous amount of fun and engagement by doing. Milton,
I appreciate your time
so much. Thank you so much for doing this.
Keep doing what you do. Stay strong, Ben.
Stay strong. Stay well. Take care. Be well. Seriously, Milton Alamadi is all the superlatives seem kind of almost not fitting. The man needs a podcast. I'm going to keep harassing him. But in the meanwhile, we'll keep doing a lot of content together. All right, folks, we're going to go to the fun half. We'll take your IMs. We'll take your calls. We do have a bunch of stories to get to, and we're running a bit over, but that was definitely well worth it. In my estimation, become a member of the Majority Report today. Less than a cup of coffee a day, about 30 cents a day. That supports and allows us to have the left positions we have, the analysis we have, to bring you something like the Milton Alamadi interview, which is profoundly important and devastatingly undercovered in corporate media. Do it. Join us. You can, of course, also become a patron of the Michael Brooks Show, where we cover a lot of the type of topics that you just saw there, but globally, Caribbean, Europe, Asia, as well as theory and other kind of more long format, more kind of long range focused content. There's a huge amount of bonus content to access, very much in that vein. Go to patreon.com/TMBS. Also, if you'll see on the Majority Report homepage, there is tickets to our LA April 20th live show with Anna Kasparian, Wozni Lambre, and Nando Vila. Get your tickets today. And if you haven't yet, go over to the Michael Brooks Show YouTube channel. It definitely helps now that we're monetized. To go over there, click on videos, subscribe, watch ads, share the word. And of course, it's a good way to check out the show. Matt, what's going on at Literary Hangover?
Yeah, Literary Hangover. I'm going to put on YouTube the video for the Unparalleled Adventures of One Hans Fall this weekend. It's it's over 3 hours long, so it's taken a while to export that altogether. And coming up this weekend is Wakefield by Nathaniel Hawthorne, a short story about a guy who decides to leave his wife one day, move across the street, and just watch how she deals with his absence for 20 years. So kind of an interesting story.
What a dick. All right. We are going to see you in the fun half.
You are in for it.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun.
Are you ready?